Okay, this is Karen Brewster, and today is October 11th, 2018, and I'm here in Skagway, Alaska, with Deborah, or Deb, Betcher, with the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project, and we're in her office here above the Pantheon Saloon in downtown Skagway. Thank you, Deb, for taking some time this afternoon. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I appreciate you coming here, too.
So, just to get us started a little bit, can you tell me where you're from originally and where you grew up?
I was born in Anchorage, and I grew up in Anchorage. Went to college at Oregon State University, graduated in zoology, went into the Peace Corps, came back to Alaska, worked for the Department of Fish and Game. Then I worked for Dames and Moore, which was an environmental consulting company when I lived in Homer, Alaska. Worked in numerous canneries. And when I worked for Fish and Game, I did that also out of Homer. I went to Bristol Bay. And what brought me to Southeast Alaska was when Fish and Game sent me down to Port Alexander as a fish sampler. And I ended up in Petersburg and lived there for several years. Worked for the hatchery, then worked for public radio, and then went to the Yukon for a summer and loved Skagway and ended up here in 1994.
Okay. I should say, we're going to get some noise in here. One, we have the noise of the heater and furnace because this is an old building, but they're doing construction out on Broadway right in front of this building. That all of a sudden now we just heard their big trucks, and so we might get some of that. Unfortunately, we can't tell them to stop.
Not. I'm afraid not.
So we will have to live with it, but at least we know what it is. So Skagway, 1994. So Peace Corps, that you said you were in Iran.
Correct.
And that was
1971 to 1974. I was there about 3 years on Vander. Okay. I was in Bandar Pahlavi, which is on the Caspian Sea, and then we moved to Tehran for the last 2 years.
Okay. And so when you were with Fish and Game and all that, you were doing zoology, biology?
We were doing smolt out-migration counts, and then we also did counts of salmon coming up the river, and you'd count from a tower.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in the offices in Dillingham as a scale manager, which is where you get scales coming in. Scales are taken from the fish, they're sampled, mm-hmm. when they're sampled, and they're sent to be aged. And they can also tell what stream, what river they're going back,
wow.
what river they came from, what river they're going back to. But actually, since you sample them from a river, that's, you know, they're migrating up the river, and that's where they're going to spawn. But I didn't age the scales or analyze the scales. I just made sure that all the scales were correct on the cards that we got back.
So you were cataloging them, basically, organizing a collection?
Kind of organizing, yep.
So when you came to Skagway in 1994, you just came as a visitor?
I had friends who were here, and I didn't want to go back to Petersburg since I had quit my job at the public radio station, and I came here right after the last cruise ship, so it was pretty quiet in town, and there weren't any jobs to be had. So I volunteered at the Park Service, which was the best thing I could have done. And I worked for Claudia Richter, who was our like a biologist at the time. I don't know if she got the title as our natural resources person, but she had a project, and that was identifying plant species, pressed plants. And I'd studied botany in college, so I was helping identify some of these plant species she's had. And while I was working there, and I'd worked for her for about a month, Doreen Cooper came in. Doreen was our archaeologist at the time, and she needed help cataloging artifacts and asked if I'd be interested in learning how to do that. And I said, I'd really be interested in that work. And I don't recall how I got hired, but I did get hired, and I worked for several winters cataloging artifacts, archaeology artifacts. And we cataloged the artifacts from Morehouse, Pantheon, and Block 39, which is where the maintenance building is.
Oh, okay.
Those artifacts. And so that gave me a background in cataloging. After they're cataloged, you enter the data into what at the time was called ANCS. And that was the catalog system that the museum program used.
And that was electronic by that point?
Correct.
It was on the computer?
So I was taught how to enter this data into the computer. At the beginning, we were cataloging everything on paper. And when you catalog, you have several fields you have to fill out, like the name, and it's based on museum nomenclature. So you're calling all, for example, windowpane glass, windowpane instead of flat glass. You have specific names for things. You have to measure it, weigh it, describe it. So there was a lot of paperwork involved. And at the time, we didn't have digital cameras, so you draw out the patterns, for example, mm-hmm. for the ceramics. Doreen actually had an archaeologist on staff who was a really good photographer. So he would select, or she would select, what artifacts she wanted photographed. So we do have a really good collection of photographs of ceramic patterns.
Nice.
And of select artifacts. But that was, to me, a fascinating project. Even though there was a lot of nails and there was a lot of window pane, there were some really interesting other artifacts. Like we got dog tags and little toys from the Morehouse because they're children there, you know. And one of the fun things now, showing the children when they come, we have fourth graders come here. And sometime during the school year, they come from Haines. And Jason, who is our chief of interp now, he used to be our education specialist. Mm-hmm. He asked me to show the children some of the artifacts. So I put several of them together, toys. And many of them are from the Morehouse, but they're from the maintenance lot, Block 39. And so there's this box of toys, and one of the first things I ask them is, how are these different from your toys? And it gets them thinking, and then how did we get the toys up here? And they'd never seen mail order catalogs, these fourth graders. They're usually fourth graders. Their toys, of course, are plastic, and the old toys are metal and ceramic. And they probably, I don't know how they order them, eBay. I don't know
Amazon.
How you order or go down the store here. But growing up, when I grew up in Anchorage, we didn't have very many stores where you could buy toys. A lot of things came out of the Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward catalogs. And they'd never seen these catalogs. But we have the catalogs from like 1898.
Wow.
And so I can show them specific toys that they're looking at right there and show them the toys in the catalog that match the toys. So they learn that. And then they learn that they didn't fly them up here. You know, you ask them, you don't tell them. And they find out that they came on probably on boats. So it's really fun to go from having cataloged those exhibit items to showing them now. But there was kind of a progression. After cataloging for three winters, Debbie Sanders, who was our museum curator, asked if I'd be interested in working in her department to help store these artifacts. And so I learned to organize them numerically in bags by their lots and store them and give them a location in our mascot collection storage room. So that was like the next step in the progression of learning how to do what I do now. And for years I worked with Debbie doing annual inventory, where you have specific inventories, museum property inventories. You've controlled, random, and now we have accession inventories. But the random inventory is the biggest, and the program generates numbers, and you have to go in and find these catalog numbers and account for all the artifacts. And if you don't find them, you have to write up a report, like where they could be and how you're going to find it. So I learned to do annual inventory, and most of it was because it's the largest piece of our, largest percentage of our collection probably is archaeological artifacts. Well, archives probably are, but they're done a little bit differently. You don't have individual items like
in archives
as you, like you do in archaeology. So you could spend several days on the annual inventory just in the mascot collection storage room looking for those artifacts. And so it was really important to have correct locations, because if you couldn't find one artifact, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. Yeah. Because they're in bags, in boxes, and in supposed to be in kind of numerical order.
And also, if for some reason an artifact was used in an exhibit or loaned to another institution, in theory, there's a paper trail for that.
Correct. You document it in the computer, and where it is, you document that it's on loan, mm-hmm. and also, you have an object removal slip that you put in the box, and then you're supposed to take it out of the box when you put the object back.
Right. So if this inventory generated a number and you couldn't find the object, if it was out on loan, in theory, it would be indicated.
That. Yeah, it should say that, because it's generated from what's called ICMS, Interior Collection Management System, and that gives you the current location of the object when you look in. And that's where the report is generated. The inventory is generated from that ICMS.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so it wouldn't ask you for a number on something that was out on loan?
Well, it does, because we have a lot of objects that are, I shouldn't say a lot, we do have objects that are on loan, for example, at Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park in Seattle. Okay. And so that is actually, they fall under our controlled property, and we have to ask Seattle to look at these artifacts and tell us if they found them, and then we report that they found them on our inventory.
Uh-huh.
And our controlled inventory is property that is on exhibit, or guns, and objects that are really expensive, things that you don't want to lose. You want to account for them.
Mm-hmm.
So those things, in the Jeff Smith's Parlor exhibit, for example, those artifacts,
mm-hmm.
they're all controlled property. Morehouse, Mascot Saloon, those items on exhibit are all controlled property. So, but the ones in Klondike, Seattle, those are controlled property, and it comes up every year.
Yeah. Make sure you still have them.
Correct.
So I don't know if you have a general sense of numbers of items in your collections. You have a sense of, like, how many archaeological pieces? You said you...
I could find that out because we generate a report every year. But I'll tell you, in our ICMS program, we have over 600,000 items.
Okay, that answers my question. And is that...
I think it's 600,000. I should look, or is it 16,000?
But that's all archaeological?
And no.
That includes the archival?
Everything, yep. Yeah, well, the archives... Mm-hmm. See, the archives are being changed right now. And I should look that up, Karen, that number. But the archives were cataloged as historical objects before, as documentary artifacts. That is being reorganized now into a new hierarchical system. But we still have a lot of all the old archives that we have stored in file cabinets are all cataloged with a number. And that is not a number, it's a number for a category. For example, let's say special events, and we have Special Events 2015. That might get one number, and it might be several events, but it might get one catalog number. Then let's say we go to another part, let's say another record group, and it's Dai excavations 1997. that get one catalog number. But that's a lot of reports. It's right. a lot of archives. Well, now we're turning it around into a different system. And what we will do is go back into the ICMS program and say, this archive, which had this catalog number, is now archived into a larger archival collection. And you get a lot of information from that old catalog number because it has a description. Mm-hmm. In the archives, you will get maybe a briefer description, or in some cases it's a broader description. For example, it could say 4th of July photos and slides, Yuletide documents. Then you can go in and describe in the archives more specifically. Okay, for Yuletide, we have a calendar, we have a poster, we have communications. You know, so it depends. But the one number doesn't indicate how many linear feet you right. have, or how many archives.
How
if
many
it's pertaining to how many folders exactly? If it's one number, it doesn't tell you.
Yeah.
How many?
Wow, it sounds like a huge project to have to redo it all.
It is, and I hope before I retire, I redo it, because we have so many boxes of archives from people who have retired in like the last, I would say, 6-7 years, that they can't be added in, or they can't be, you can't go through them and say, we already have this report, we don't need it, until these are all reorganized.
And so is this reorganization more in keeping with standard archival procedures?
I believe so.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
This started when we got our second curator. After Debbie Sanders left, Samantha Rickard was our second curator. And she started, oh man, I can't remember, about 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay.
And when she came on board, that was one of her first changes, was the way we cataloged our archives. And I thought, I will never learn this system. It's a string of numbers, a long string of numbers with periods in between the numbers. But now I think in those numbers, and I can look at a string of numbers. Oh, those are archaeology archives. Oh, those are maintenance archives. Those are natural history archives.
Okay.
I can think that way now. But it was so different when I had to start learning it.
Yeah.
And when we got individual collections called assembled collections in, everyone's different. You might get a collection, archival collection, from somebody who's got all photographs. You might have photographs, ephemera, tape, reel-to-reel tape, for example, slides, and every single one's different. And those are a real challenge, because there's no consistency. And you have to look at the collection over and over and over and think, okay, how am I going to divide this up? What are my groupings? And they're challenging, but boy, when you finish one, you feel so good. Because it's so manageable.
Yeah.
You can go in and find the photographs you're looking for.
I don't know how, even if you can think about how many archives collections you have here. Do you have any sense of how many individual collections on the archive side?
Well, I've cataloged at least probably a dozen, and then there were ones that were already cataloged, so I would say there's at least 20 assembled collections. And sometimes we have, when I go in and see these archives were, for example, from somebody, and they've been archived as with a catalog number in a record group, it just fits better as a collection,
mm-hmm.
An assembled collection. So I'll reorganize it and make it an assembled collection, because it just doesn't fit in our hierarchy. It's not from maintenance, it's not from natural resources, it's not from cultural resources. It's somebody's collection that was cataloged under Skagway General. For example.
Or what if there's some person off the street who comes in, or a local resident who says, here, I've got all this stuff. Well, do you take those collections?
It depends. And I'm not the one who accepts it. It's our museum curator. And it has to fit our scope of collection. If it's our scope of collection is not as broad as the city's, as the museum's, okay. City Museum's collection, because they're not just dealing with Gold Rush era collections. Ours are Gold Rush era. Our scope of collection is sort of Gold Rush era and pertaining to some of our buildings. And it goes up to about 1916, 1898, around there to about 1916. So if somebody brings in a collection and we look at, for example, let's say a bottle collection. I look at the bottles and I'll tell the museum curator, okay, these bottles predate 1916. These bottles are more modern. We might say to the donor, okay, we could take these bottles, but these other ones don't fit our scope of collection. It has to fit the scope of collection before we can accept. And some of the one of the decisions a curator has to make, if somebody's going to just give you a collection and it's Gold Rush era, and mostly Gold Rush, are you going to take it all? And if it doesn't make your scope of collection, would they mind if we gave it to the library so they could use it for educational purposes? So you have to kind of talk to the donor, mm-hmm. and see what their expectations are. And they say, no, I want it all to go in the museum and be treated like museum property. Then I think the museum curator has to decide, do we want to accept this whole thing, this whole collection, when part of it doesn't match mm-hmm. our scope of collection? They have to make that judgment call.
But I didn't realize that the Skagway City Museum took in donations and collections.
Well, they have a scope of collection also.
Okay.
So if somebody brings them a collection and that person can't tell them where it came from, it might not have come from Skagway. Mm-hmm. They probably wouldn't take it in. But usually they have a scope of collection too, and it probably has to be artifacts that pertain to Skagway.
Well, like what, for example, you know, if a local person has photos from the World War II era mm-hmm. in their family collection, the park would not be interested in those?
We do have some World War II photos. They don't fall in our scope of collection. We ended up with them. But the city museum would be the correct repository. And I don't know why we have those in our collection, but we do.
It just seems like by now all of the Gold Rush history would have been discovered, other than, you know, new archaeological excavations where you would get new material. But in terms of photo collections and archival things, you'd think it would already be here.
Well, you'd be surprised. There are people who hiked the Chilkoot Trail, like in 1970s. See, the Chilkoot Trail falls in our scope of collection.
Right.
So we'd be really interested in those photographs. And people come up with their grandparents or their great-grandparents' memorabilia.
They're still coming with that.
Oh, they still do. And at our visitor center, we have something called a stampeder form. And the donor can fill it, or let's say the relative mm-hmm. can fill out the stampeder form, which has the name of the relative, what the relationship is, what the relative did. And if they came through Skagway, going up to the gold fields, we'll ask them also if there's anything that they know that this person has in the collection. And it could be photos, diary, letters. If they check these boxes, then the curator will get back to that person, the one who filled out the form, and ask if they would be interested in donating any of these materials. And some of them say, well, we can send you a photocopy of the diary. Fine. Then we have something on file. Because sometimes people will come and say, I think my great-grandfather came through here. Do you have anything in your files? And we say, what is his name? And then we can look it up in our files and under the stampeder files and say, oh, we do have some information on your great-grandfather.
Yeah.
And it will be maybe a diary or photographs that we got from another donor that is probably a relative of that person also.
That's the whole challenge of archives and museums work, is organizing it all so you can find the items again.
Right.
When you need them.
And that's one of my, one of the challenges, but also one of the rewards, is when somebody calls up with a research question, and this happens a lot. We had over 100 research requests last year. And some of them will last days, some of them last just a few minutes. But when you can find what they're looking for or the information, it is so rewarding because you organized your archives so that you could find what they were asking for. And somebody, for example, wanted, let's say they want to donate something, a telephone insulator, or let's say an insulator.
Mm-hmm.
You can look through your collection and tell them all the insulators that you have, but we don't have that one. I mean, you can do a search like that and say, well, we don't have that specific insulator in our collection, and it dates to 1898, so sure, we might be interested in that.
That's really cool.
So it's very cool. And the archives, the photographs are, I get a lot of requests for photographs, and so we scan a lot of photographs and send them to people. But questions like, do you have this photograph in your collection? The library is really good too. Our library,
yeah, because the park library.
The park library. Mm-hmm. They're harder to search unless there's a number attached, like an inventory number from the Rapuzzi collection, because we don't have a good search mechanism. Like, it's a picture with tents and the stampeders going up the golden stairs on the Chilton mm-hmm. Trail. Well, how many of those would? I mean, we have so many of those to look through every single one. That's a little bit harder of a search.
So the park library also has collections of photographs and things?
Correct, but they have photographs for educational purposes, so they might be photographs that are in other people's collections and not the parks. We have original photographs in the museum collection.
Okay.
And they're usually, we have the unrestricted use so that people can use our photographs. However, and they cite them
right.
with a catalog number, Klondike right. Gold Rush National Historical Park with a catalog number. The library has a huge collection of photographs, but they might be copies from other people's collections. So you would cite the collection that it came from.
Right.
And it's not in our possession, it's not in our park.
And because I was talking to Carl Gerke this morning, as the historian, he uses historic photos a lot.
A lot.
And mm-hmm. I asked him how the amassing of that collection, and he sort of said, well, Bob Spoody, who did a lot of the building research early on, got photos from other institutions, and then Carl keeps amassing photos. Now, are those photos part of your museum collection, or that's Carl's personal?
That's part of the library collection.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They have more photos, a lot more than we do, because they have scanned other people's photos.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to cite them as other
right.
people, you know, from
right.
or
if
the
I
proper
want,
collection.
If I wanted to use it, the park wouldn't give me permission. I'd have to go back to the State Library in Juneau or
correct.
Burke Museum or wherever to get the official permission.
Correct. And for these the reports that are generated in the park, you'll see that, courtesy of.
Mm-hmm.
And also in our different exhibits, you'll see photograph courtesy of. And they're from other institutions.
And they're not officially accessioned into the museum collection.
They aren't at all.
Well, that's confusing.
Well, ours, if it was a Park Service photograph, it would say Klondike Gold Rush National right. Historical Park, KLGO, which is our acronym, KL for the... It's the first two letters of each.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Klondike and Geo
Gold
is Gold Rush.
Right.
And then it would have a catalog number. It would have 3 digits, 4 digits, whatever, mm-hmm. catalog number. And that way, if somebody's interested in getting a copy of that photograph, they can say it's catalog number, KLGO, 1234, whatever.
And then you can go find it.
Correct.
So where are all your collections stored? Are they in this building we're in right now?
Different buildings. Our archaeology collection is stored in Mascot Saloon. A downstairs, and I don't know if this is confidential information or not, but our archives are stored right here in Pantheon.
Well, they're all behind locked doors.
They're all behind, correct, not only locked with a special key, they also have alarms.
Yeah, I would think so. You mentioned the Rapuzzi collection. Were you involved in that?
That was my first. Well, for years I worked cleaning trains for White Pass, concurrently with working for the museum curator in the spring and the fall, and part-time while I was cleaning trains for White Pass for 11 summers. And I resigned from that position when the Rapuzzi collection was acquired. The Rapuzzi collection was bought by the Rasmussen Foundation and given to the city to share with the Park Service. And the city actually manages the Rapuzzi collection. And we, the park, hired two people, technicians, to inventory the Rapuzzi collection. And the city had a couple people to inventory this collection. And originally it was, I don't know how many, thousands and thousands, but we kind of narrowed it down. I think our curators decided it was about 30,000 items. And I wouldn't say they're individual items, because we would have a barrel of nails. Now, how many nails? You know, that would be maybe one inventory number.
How long is a piece of string?
So I applied for the job of museum technician, and that was a 4-year position to help with this inventory. It turned out the inventory took 8 years.
Wow.
And in the end, I was inventorying all by myself. And the descriptions got better with time, because people were searching for things. And so we had to get better descriptions. In the beginning, it was like box, wood box. Okay, later on, it's a wood box, but it has this printed on the side, you know?
Yeah.
And then it got so that it had patent dates. We had patent dates. And those were important. Also, we did a lot of research on the artifacts, because the two curators had to decide who got what. The city decided what fit their scope of collection. Our museum curator decided what fit our scope of collection, what was Gold Rush. And also, she had to look at the photograph of what was really important before she retired. Debbie Sanders was obtaining all the objects that went back into Soapy Smith's parlor, Jeff Smith's parlor, uh-huh, museum, because those were original artifacts that are in the museum now. And we had to find those all in this collection. And the collection was huge. It filled Jeff Smith's parlor, the commissary, World War II commissary. It was all outside the yard of the commissary, mm-hmm, and the yard of Jeff Smith's parlor. The Alaskan building, which is down by the maintenance building, the whole, besides being in the Alaskan building, and it was so full of stuff, the furniture was like piled on top of itself. And then shelving, like bookshelves like you see in a library, filled with stuff.
Where had George Rapuzzi have all of it before it got transferred? Did he have it in all these multiple places?
I think so. And the Alaskan building, now I don't know if he had things there. They were a lot of the artifacts and artifacts and paper items were moved out of the Fifth Avenue building, the one that they're restoring over there.
The YMCA
and the Myers Meat Market, that complex there. There was a person who was a friend of Phyllis Brown, the donor. And Phyllis Brown, by the way, was George Rapuzzi's wife's niece. She was the sole, like, survivor. When George died first, then Edna died, her niece acquired the collection. And Phyllis lived in the Alaskan building. She had an apartment there. And then the Alaskan offices were where a lot of the stuff was stored. But I believe that it came out of the YMCA, that Fifth Avenue complex. And a person who was her friend Ron Klein, who lives in Juneau, was one of the people that was instrumental, I think, in moving some of the materials over to the Alaskan building. He came over early on when we first started doing the inventory, and he told us the importance of the different items in the Alaskan building, and he went around to the different yards. And outside the Alaskan building, it was big metal, stoves and tractors, carts, wheeled carts, compressors, big drills. It was all over, all these metal items outside. It was just so, and there were 3-4 trailers full of artifacts over there. Furniture piled on top of furniture.
Well, and from my understanding, it's not like, oh, George had one stove. He'd have how many of very...
Multiple stoves. Right. And just the picks alone, I think he must have taken a pick home every single day from White Pass. No, I don't know how he acquired all these railroad picks and these shovels, but I understand he worked for White Pass, but he also went to the dump. He was a collector.
Yeah.
And before that, Martin Itchen had collected, but I think, and Martin Itchen also made a lot of really amazing, I don't know what you call them, automatons.
Mm.
You see, like Soapy Smith.
Uh-huh.
Or Jeff Smith in right. The Parlor, and Lady Lou and Dan McGrew, he made all those,
wow.
which were very clever.
Yeah.
So he George Rapuzzi acquired all of these artifacts that were in the Jeff Smith's parlor when Martin Itchen owned it. He acquired that also.
Right.
And then also his house was full of artifacts, nice artifacts. So. And he had a shop downstairs in the basement that you wouldn't believe was so full of stuff, jars. And so when we inventoried, it could be a box of jars that were full of, each jar was full of screws, washers, and bolts, nuts. And so this would get maybe one catalog number. It's not an indication of how many things there were. It could be a box of jars with hardware. So it took, but it took a long time, and that was year round.
And you had to catalog to that level?
No.
Just to know what you had?
This was inventory.
Inventory, okay.
Correct.
So you had to say, this is a box of jars of hardware. You couldn't just go, no, we don't want this, and throw it away.
No. Everything got a number. And then the two museum curators decided who was going to get what. And Debbie had to make the decision of getting all of the artifacts for Jeff Smith's parlor, right. which was really fun. And then another part of the process, besides doing the inventory, was if, and we did this almost on a daily basis, or maybe not daily, but we would inventory, but after they decided who got what, then we had to clean the artifacts. And the city and the Park Service, technicians would clean them over in the mascot saloon, and we had to track them, what came in, what went out, and where it went. And then once it went over to the storage area for the Rapuzzi collection for the park, then we had to give it a location, and all of this was on paper and entered in the computer. So it was really involved.
Yeah. And you were the only one.
We had almost always two technicians until the last 2 years. And then I was on my own.
Yeah.
So it would go on paper, come back here, get inventoried. I mean, entered into the computer then. Okay, I had already inventoried the computer. I mean, the curator selected it, take it out, clean it.
And then once it's selected, then it has to be accessioned and cataloged officially as part of your collection.
Correct. And it hasn't been cataloged yet.
Oh, it
some
has
of
not.
Them, there's still a lot of artifacts that have to be cataloged. But everything that's on exhibit in the museum, Jeff Smith's Parlor Museum, right. that's been cataloged. Correct. And then there are a lot of artifacts that have been cataloged, but there are numerous artifacts that have not. And also, along with the Rapuzzi collection, we also got archives, which will not be processed for a while. The ones that were Martin Itchen archives, that I've processed most of Martin Itchen's papers, documents, records,
cool,
his recordings. But we have boxes of ship manifests.
Wow.
They have to be conserved before they can even be archived or cataloged, I should say. So that's, I mean, massive undertaking right there.
Yeah. And yeah, so there's all this Rapuzzi stuff just sitting someplace. I mean, those boxes of jars are with nails in them. Did they get included, or were there things?
They went into storage. Mm-hmm.
So
they had to come out of these.
So things either went
buildings.
To the City Museum or you guys. There was nothing that got thrown out or not accepted.
Some of the stuff was so deteriorated in the yards that, and also some of the artifacts were, let's say, old sheetrock piled up. That was something that, you know, who was going to store that?
Right.
So some of the stuff did get thrown out because it was so disintegrated it couldn't be stored or selected.
It sounds like an overwhelming project.
It was fascinating. Every day I'd go to work, I thought, what am I going to get to see today? It was one of the most interesting, enjoyable, rewarding jobs I've ever had.
Cool.
And the research on the artifacts was so interesting. We'd get, for example, a little tiny tray with a little child, like a little girl on it. What was that used for? It was like fairy soap. And you can see it in Jefferson's parlor.
Yeah.
And then we'd do the research on it. We'd go to the computer and go to Google and look up fairy soap, and then we could find out when it was used, what it was used for. It's like a little advertising tray.
Ooh.
And it was so interesting.
Cool.
And it came from England, for example. We'd find, I mean, most interesting things when we did some research on some of these artifacts. And we keep files of that. So when an artifact is cataloged, there is a field for, do you have a folder for it? And if you say yes, that means there's further research. And you can even say that in the description, that this is from England and these are the dates. See the file folder.
Are there anything you came across in the Rapuzzi collection that just had no idea what it was?
We had lots of things like that. In fact, we had exhibits for 3 summers that were called the What's It exhibit, and they were in the visitor center. And we had forms that people could fill out to tell us what they knew about a particular artifact, and we have them all numbered. They were things that we didn't know about. What is this? And some of the answers were really off the wall, but that's how we found out what some of these artifacts
were. So some of them,
and people loved that exhibit.
So some of them the people actually knew.
Oh, yes, especially the hardware and the tools and some of the electrical stuff. We have lots of books for those kinds of things, but some of them were not in the books. And we'd put it out there, and we got some really good answers. And then we'd look at it, we'd look up the answer, what the person had said, and sure enough, that's exactly what it was.
Cool.
So there were a lot of things like that. And I didn't know tools. I didn't know until I started working and using these books that we have. And what's really, really helpful were some of the mail order catalogs, like Montgomery Ward, because they had the tools that people were using here at the turn of the century. And we had a really good exhibit. I thought one of the best ones was Dream Books, where we took artifacts that we had in our collection from the Rapuzzi collection and that we found actually identified from a Montgomery Ward catalog or Sears Roebuck catalog from 1898.
So you'd have the object and then next to it the image of the page or the ad or something?
Correct. In some cases we did. And one of them that comes to mind was the shoe lasts. Like we had these metal, little metal feet. They were shaped, they were shaped like a shoe.
Right, right.
The base of a shoe.
I know what you mean, yeah.
And then they had a stand. And I think it was Montgomery Ward's, was selling the whole kit, little cobbler kit. You could repair your shoes at home.
Oh.
And we have all these shoe lasts and stands, and that was one thing that we found in the Montgomery Ward catalog. And we had a picture of that right next to the, that cool. You could get the whole kit for the with different size shoe lasts and from the catalog.
Cool.
And we had that right next to the.
Yeah, I was because I was going to ask you, you know, as such a huge collection, how can you be an expert on all the different types of things? I mean, there are, you know, archaeologists who become experts on, you know, the nails, or they become an expert on the ceramics or something, but a vast collection like that.
I know. Well, I can now tell you a lot of electrical items that I had no idea the names of before I started, because we have a MESCO catalog here, and you just thumb through it, you find the ceramic section. Oh, that's a rosette. Okay, that's a wire, whatever.
So definitely an on-the-job learning experience.
It was, every day I was learning. That's, I think, what made it so fascinating. And I was seeing things I had never seen before, and probably never will again, except in this collection. Posters, oh, beautiful. Posters from like the 30s. And, I mean, the advertising, some of the advertising was amazing from years ago, and we had lots of big, colorful posters. And I don't know how they were used in town or who used them. And I think the city acquired almost all of them. But the artwork was amazing. And the hardware from the Victorian era, very ornate hardware, wow. Beautiful doorknobs, and I want to say, well, I'm thinking of all the door hardware, window hardware, the latches. And yeah, just very ornate and beautiful, different kinds of doorknobs, materials. Ceramic, glass, and embossed metal doorknobs. It was, yeah.
And thank goodness for hoarders, I guess.
I know. Yeah, he amassed $1 million collection by hoarding all this stuff. And I think of his wife, I guess she just accepted the way George was, because They had buildings full of stuff, you know, but look at all the treasures that were saved because of his hoarding or his collecting, you know? Things that may have been thrown away, discarded, burned, who knows?
So the inventory is done on that project eight years later. But as you say, it still needs to be cataloged, accessioned. Mm-hmm. How long is that going to take?
Years.
Somebody else's lifetime?
No, if somebody could just focus on that. My focus right now is to reorganize the archives. But if I was to focus on cataloging that, I would guess maybe 2 years, 3 years, if that was all I was doing. Mm-hmm. But
it's never all you're doing.
No, and when you're a museum technician, that's what is fun, is you are doing a lot of other things, because you have to put the exhibits together in the spring. Oh. You have research requests, and that will put the brakes on everything that you're doing sometimes. And you have to clean all your collection storage areas. You have annual reporting. And it's the museum curator who does the annual reporting, but the museum technician is the one who goes and measures how many linear feet of archives have been, you know, cataloged this year and reorganized, for example. And you're the one who does kind of the counting. And then the museum curator will do the reporting. But there are a lot of other things that you have to do. If you do catalog, before you catalog something, you have to clean it. And if you get new accessions in, which are like new collections, and the curator accessions them, then you might have several historical artifacts that you have to stop and catalog, so you can give them a storage location. You can give them So there are a lot of things that a person, if they're just sitting down and just cataloging, like the Rapuzzi collection. That would be in the ideal world.
Right.
But that's not how it is in real life. You have so many other things to do in addition to what you want to focus on so that you can get it knocked out, but that's not how it happens.
And the park is continuing to do archaeological excavations, correct?
Well, so we haven't had any big excavations in a while.
Okay.
So, because they haven't acquired any areas where they're going to, for example, restore a building.
Mm-hmm.
But usually that's what they have to do before they restore a building. And they haven't done anything like that since the Fifth Avenue building.
Right.
So that was maybe 2010.
They're not doing any work out in Dyea that they're bringing collections into you?
Not this year. They did a salvage 2012 because the Chilkoot Trail, there was a site out there that was eroding into the river. And so they went out and did a salvage. And that was the last time I think they brought in any artifacts.
So it's not like every summer you're getting big archaeological collections, because that would be very challenging.
Yep, and it used to be that archaeology cataloged the artifacts. This winter I cataloged artifacts that had not finished cataloging, and there was nobody on staff to do it, so I finished cataloging those artifacts this past summer. But usually archaeology does the cataloging and then on a spreadsheet, and then our museum curator will import it into our museum collection system.
Now, you mentioned exhibits. So the museum curatorial staff does the exhibits, the interpretation staff doesn't do those?
It depends. The exhibits that the museum is responsible for are the Morehouse, Mascot Saloon, and Jeff Smith's Parlor. Those are museum objects. The new exhibit in the visitor center falls under interpretation, even though there are museum objects in there. When we do our annual inventory, those objects are controlled property, so we will inventory them. But as far as the care of that exhibit, most of those artifacts are not original, and they don't fall under the museum. They fall under the interpretation.
So at the Morehouse, Mascot, and Jeff Smith's, do you do new exhibits every year?
No, what we do is we clean them. I clean those spaces every Monday, and I can get behind the railing and clean I get behind the railing and clean those areas, whereas the custodians don't.
Right.
And so that's once a week throughout the summer. We close those exhibits up. We cover everything up. We take, in the Moore Cabin, we take the, we have panels of newspaper in there to show people what the Moore Cabin used to look like when it was covered with newspaper.
Oh.
We removed that newspaper years ago. I'm trying to think what year, because I helped with that project. All the original newspaper, and it's stored here. And we had reproduction vinyl newspapers put up, and we put them up. We put them on panels on Velcro, and they go up on the walls every spring. They come down in the fall. So we open and close the exhibits every year. We used to have temporary exhibits in the visitor center and in the museum, Park Service Museum, over in the admin building. And that was something that we did in the spring. One of us would be responsible for a particular exhibit. So I might have the one in the visitor center, and our curator might have the one in the museum. And those were temporary exhibits, and they had a theme. And we also did the windows. We also put in exhibits in the windows over in the admin building. Those exhibits had to be, until we got the Rapuzzi collection, they were usually metal items or ceramic. They were things that could tolerate light.
Mm-hmm.
But once we acquired the Rapuzzi collection, we could select artifacts that were called educational artifacts. They did not have to be accessioned, and they did not have to be treated as museum artifacts. They could be used for educational purposes, and then we acquired things like chairs, boxes that we could put in those windows. And so every year we had different window exhibits, and those were really fun. We had a Chilkoot Trail tent exhibit. We made the tent, and we put in boxes and silverware, all metal, you know, to display. But we were responsible for these temporary exhibits. And that's when we had the What's It exhibit every year for like 3 years in the visitor center. And we had the Victorian hardware exhibit. We had one exhibit that was natural history exhibit. And that was just an exhibit to look at to see what kinds of natural history artifacts we have. And people loved it. We had skulls, bird mounts, and let's say study skins, fish.
Plant samples.
Plants. We had our herbarium specimens, lichens. It was a really fun exhibit. And you didn't have to do any reading. You could just look.
And you have all that kind of stuff in your collections, that Correct. Natural history material also.
The natural history material is stored in a different room from our archives and our historical
But
artifacts.
You do have some of those items now in your
we
collection.
We do. It's not huge, but our herbarium is huge.
Cool.
And we have a really good, beautiful plant, mounted plants, pressed mounted plants in our herbarium. And we also have, I think, the most lichens of any national park in the United States, the biggest variety of lichens. It's because we go from sea level to alpine, and we've had Forest Service lichenologists come in here, and they've done air quality monitoring, and they've collected samples, and we have samples that they've collected. We have a huge collection of lichens.
And so those exhibits at the Moore House and the Mascot and Jeff Smith, they're the same every year, or
Correct.
Do you have a theme? No.
They're the same every year. We just clean them and open them up in the spring, uncover everybody.
But you don't
all the different artifacts are covered, and
you don't remove them from those buildings and bring them back into storage.
No, the only one we do that to is the Moore Cabin, and that's to take down the wallpaper panels.
Yeah,
the squirrels can get in there, and and they will.
Yeah.
So we just remove those. And
because those buildings aren't heated in the winter, are they?
The Moore House is. Jeff Smith's parlor, I think it's heated a little bit. And the Mascot, the heat's on, correct. Mm-hmm. They are. Well, because they have plumbing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they don't have to be heated to human comfort. Okay, we're back from a phone call interruption, and we're going to talk about confirming how many objects. So you just went and looked at the last catalog
number I assigned.
And it was?
61,503.
Okay.
But that is not an indication how many artifacts we have. And I'll explain the difference.
Okay.
When you're cataloging, for example, archaeological artifacts, say you have a pile of window pane and it's all 7/64 of an inch thick, and it's from exactly the same lot, the same level.
But that's, it might be lots of little pieces.
Correct. Let's say it's 105 pieces, because you've just counted out this huge pile of window pane, divided it into 4/64, 5/64, 6/64, 7/64 of an inch, example, 8/64, 9/64.
That's the thickness.
It's the thickness, it's and the you glass. Measure with calipers. And you have piles of it, all different thicknesses. All the same thickness is cataloged with one catalog number, because it's all the same. It's all window pane. It's all 6/64 of an inch thick.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be 105 pieces. That gets one catalog number.
And then,
it's all the same thing. And
right.
then you measure it for length, width, thickness. The thickness is all the same. Just you have a range of lengths and widths.
So would you say 105 pieces of 664th glass, this many or this long and wide, this many or this long?
No, you would just say length, 0.1 centimeters to 10.1 centimeters length, width, 0.4 centimeters to 1.5 centimeters, example. Right. And then thickness.
So 61,000 catalog numbers
is not an indication of how many artifacts you have.
How many actual items.
Correct. And you might have one catalog number for special events 2016. But in the archives, that might be five file folders. With correspondence, memorabilia, posters. You know, so it's one catalog number, but it might have 64 objects in it.
Okay. Now, you started working on all this in the mid to late 90s. Do you know what was happening with their museum collection cataloging before that? Did they have anything organized?
Debbie Sanders, I think, was cataloging historical artifacts, and before she came, other people were cataloging. We had, I don't know who exactly was responsible for this, but we have an accessions book, which it lists all the collections.
Mm-hmm.
And there are over 500 collections. Actually, we're up to, I'll tell you.
Because they certainly were doing all those
over
old...
644 accessions. So those are kind of like collections.
Right.
And there were accessions in the book before Debbie Sanders, our first curator, was hired. And I'm not sure who was responsible for that.
Well, they certainly were doing archaeological work with all that historic building restoration.
Correct.
So obviously they were acquiring material. And
that was Denver Service Center who was doing the original collecting around here.
Right.
And they took the artifacts, I believe, back to Denver, cataloged them there, and then sent them back to us.
Okay.
So that was before we had our first curator even.
Right. And they sent them back here to some building.
Yeah. They're stored in the mascot.
Oh, okay.
Collection storage area.
They were put someplace.
Yep.
Okay. Was I just going to ask about that? No, I can't remember.
You asked who was responsible for the collections.
Well, yeah, but anyway, I'll think of it again. I know one thing. Carl mentioned when I talked to him, one of Martin Itchen's old vehicles. Is that familiar sounding to you?
Mm-hmm. We have one of his vehicles left, and that was the original number one Skagway streetcar. And that was restored this past not this year, but a year ago.
So 2017?
Correct.
And
we had a group of people come up here and work on it. It was moved to another building over in the harbor, and they conserved it. They cleaned it up, drained some fluids, fixed things that... Actually, conserved it. They didn't restore it. And labeled what the different levels controlled.
Oh.
It's stored now. But eventually maybe it will go on display over in one of the Fifth Avenue buildings that they're restoring right now,
okay.
I hope.
Yeah, can it fit inside a building?
It could. It's not that big of a vehicle.
Okay.
It's like a minibus size. You know the little tour buses we have around here, you know, the vans.
Yeah, so what, 12-seater?
It wasn't designed that way. We had like a carriage on the back.
Okay.
So it could maybe hold 12 people, but it's they aren't regular seats like a coach,
right.
Like a, let's say, a bus. The seats are a bench seat on either side in the back, and then the driver was in the front. And that belonged to Martin Itchen. There were three streetcars. Two of them were commissioned by the military, the two other ones, number two and three. And then I believe they were destroyed after World War II. And this is the only remaining one. And it was too small
for their needs. So thank goodness. Yeah, or we maybe wouldn't have any
street. Do you know how it came to the Park Service?
It was in the Rapuzzi collection.
Oh, it was part of the Rapuzzi collection.
Correct. And Martinichin, we have Martinichin's house. Right. It's the blue building across from the visitor center.
It's the Alaska Geographic store.
Correct. That's his house. And then the museum used to be, Carl probably told you this, over on 6th Avenue. It used to be
like the Jeff Smith Parlor Museum. Yeah, correct. It was over by the bank.
Correct. Said, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then it was moved across the street, and it became the Hose and Ladder Company. It belonged to the fire hall, I believe.
Yeah.
And Martinichin acquired it, and he made it into a museum, and that was at the end of his tour. People would get to go into his museum. That was moved by George Rapuzzi over to its current location.
On 2nd
and off of Broadway. He maintained it as a museum, added more artifacts, and he had tours. He died in 1986, and I think his museum was moved, that museum was moved about 1963 or 64 to its current location.
Okay.
And he had tours in there, but he also worked, so I don't know how he did both, but I think he had somebody helping over there giving tours.
Yeah.
And we have pictures of Edna giving a tour, too, so she helped over there. I don't know how long he was open, if he was only open when the ferry was in. I'm not sure.
Well, and there weren't 10,000 million tourists coming in every day.
Correct.
So it might have been easier.
But he did give tours because we have posters in the collection that were painted by Bea Lingle, mm-hmm. a local person. And I asked her, where were these little posters used? They were small posters. And she said they were used in different businesses to encourage people to come to Jeff Smith's Parlor Museum,
fun.
George's tours. And we have, like, times, and the times would be whited out, like 1 to 3, okay, nope, 2 to 4. You can see they were changed. So I guess it depended on his schedule when they could have a tour or somebody's schedule, because they weren't open all the time. And we have one of the, I think, priceless things we have in our collection is the register, where people could sign in and then write their comments when George had the museum. And people I know, as adults, they signed in when they were children.
Oh.
And you could ask them about what, and we did ask people, because we were trying to figure out what did Lady Lou do, because we heard, conflicting reports of, because these automatons could move.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody say, she was in the bathroom, so when you open the door, she would raise her arms up and scream. And somebody'd say, her eyes would light up. And, we didn't know, but they all had impressions that she did something. The people that were local people that I had seen their signature when they were mm-hmm. children, and I asked them later, or we had a meeting and invited local people in to tell us what they remember about Martinichin Museum, Sophie Smith Museum. And that's where, we got a lot of these reports, but just seeing these people's names when they were children was,
that's
to
fun.
Me, it was wonderful.
So also in your collections, do you have oral history recordings and old film?
Oh, we do. We have so many oral history. Well, I shouldn't say so many. I don't know what to compare to. We have a lot. And one of our volunteers organized them because they come in different mediums. We have oral histories on cassettes, some are on video, some have been transcribed, some have DVDs and CDs made from them, they've been digitized. So they've been organized, and you can search by name and find out, and what's really helpful is if it's been transcribed, So we sent a lot of them out to Safe Sound Archives, and they digitized them and transcribed them. So they're very usable now. And we have some more that have been sent out to University of Alaska, I think, that are mm-hmm. being digitized right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an extensive collection of oral histories. And when Frank Norris was doing the administrative history, we have lots of oral history recordings from that period as well.
He recorded, mm-hmm. when he interviewed people for that admin history, he recorded them?
Yes.
Okay, great.
And we have those filed as well. Archived, I should say. And they're all kept in a building that has constant humidity and temperature. It's regulated, mm-hmm. so they're in a safe environment. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of film, and film in the form of negatives, slides, and reel-to-reel film. Not so many reel-to-reel films, but we have some. And all of those have been frozen. We had a project where Harpers Ferry conservation people came up here, and it was called Cold Storage Project. We had to measure how many cubic feet of film archives we had. Film meaning negative slides and reel-to-reel film. Somebody bought two freezers, and they are just full of boxes. Those are what we put them in.
The archival boxes.
We put them in sleeves, all the slides and all the negatives in sleeves, and then you fill those boxes with foam. You double wrap them, put them in a metal sleeve, and then you put it in a plastic, bag, mm-hmm. and have to make them airtight, so you have to tape them up really well, and they all go into the freezer. And we have 47 boxes like that in the freezers. And if somebody requests a slide, we say, no, please, can you look at a photograph instead? Because to take something out of the freezer and let it stabilize for a couple days and then open the box and then find the slide and then scan the slide and then put it all back together and put it back in the freezer it takes a lot of time.
Well, I would think if somebody requested a slide while you have the box out and reacclimated, just scan the whole box.
Do you know how long it takes to scan the whole box of slides?
Yes.
I've scanned some slides, and you do something else while you're scanning slides, yeah. because they take a long time. You put 20 slides in a little bracket thing, mm-hmm. and you scan it, and it takes, 5 minutes plus. So meanwhile, you're doing something else.
Right.
Then you go back. And then you have to label your slides. Digitally label.
Right.
You give them a name.
Right.
Correct. It takes a lot of time. That would be a wonderful volunteer project.
So the years you were here, sort of the late 90s, early 2000s, I have an impression that things at the park were somewhat difficult administratively. Do you have any memory of that?
I don't, because I worked another job, and I just came in here part-time. So if there were problems, I wasn't involved. I just worked for the curator, and we got along just fine. And I started working full-time when I retired from White Pass in about 2008.
Okay.
After we acquired the Rapuzzi Collection, that's when I was hired full-time for a term position. And then I got a second term position, a different position, so it was 8 years. But I worked for the curator, and I wasn't involved in, if there were problems in admin, I wasn't affected.
It didn't, the problems in leadership didn't trickle down?
No. And when I was doing the inventory, I wasn't even in this building.
Right.
I was in the other buildings. I just check in the morning, might enter the data from the day before in the computer, and then go off and inventory and clean and then store. So, no, I wasn't involved in any park politics. If there were problems, I wasn't involved.
Okay.
Thank goodness.
Were you ever aware of how the community felt about the park and what the park was doing?
initially when I came here and I was volunteering at the park, I felt there was a real difference. The park, some of the park people felt it was us and them. And I was one of them, actually, because I wasn't employed by the park when I first came here. And I liked being in the park because it gave me something to do and interesting people to work with. And I was getting to work in plants. So I had studied botany. I was really glad to be getting back to working with natural history items. And then I became employed by White Pass, like 2 years later. And so I was on both sides of the fence.
Right.
And a lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot, some people at White Pass were really suspect because I worked for the Park Service too. But some of them became good friends of mine. But I could feel there was an animosity by some people towards our park, towards their park also, towards the park, because they didn't like all the tourists coming to town. And since Park Service was responsible for restoring some of these buildings and was a presence in the park, that was why so many people were coming to Skagway, and they felt they liked it the way it was before. But on the other hand, I don't know that White Pass would have been so successful if it hadn't been for the tourism. Mm-hmm. And they were benefiting from all the tourists coming because they had jobs, because White Pass was the biggest, probably, excursion, most popular excursion in town.
Right.
So there's still people that probably resent the Park Service having come in and because a park was established here. But I don't think there's a lot of those people.
So you feel like it's changed since you first got here?
I think so. But I'm glad I got to work for White Pass, because I think that the people that I worked with, that I became friends with, saw that the Park Service was, you know, they weren't the bad neighbors.
Right. You were.
The Park Service also employed a lot of local people. They employed people when the railroad shut down. And some of those people, one of those people, I know, just recently retired from the park. And so the Park Service provided jobs for local people. So I think maybe the opinion has changed a little bit since I came here, because their friends and neighbors, relatives, have been employed by the park.
Right. And they've seen Park Service in general, you know, people tend to move around a lot. But maybe here there are people who came and were employed and settled here, and maybe that helped people in the community see, oh, they're not so bad.
I think so, too. And also, a boost to the economy is the Park Service people could pay some of the rents here in town. Mm-hmm. And I think that was helpful.
Yeah.
Because it gave people renters year-round. They weren't just seasonal renters. But one thing that has changed, though, is a lot of the companies now have bought some of these private homes, and they are only occupied seasonally. But the Park Service is here year-round and renting from people year-round, and I think that has helped the economy a lot.
Just from talking to you and seeing you here in your office, I can tell you've enjoyed this work with the museum collections.
It's been wonderful. I have learned so much, but it's the Park Service has been a wonderful place to work, because I feel like I'm always learning something, and it's never the same day after day after day. And I've worked in canneries, lots of canneries around Alaska, and it's the same work day in and day out. But I come to work here, and I think I'm going to do this today, and then I end up doing something totally different. It just depends. If I get a research request in the morning, then that's going to change my day a little bit, my plans. But very seldom does a day turn out the way I think it is going to, or the way I plan it to be. It just doesn't happened that way.
Is there, looking back through all the years and the different things you've done, are there certain things or certain times that have been particularly challenging or harder?
Here in the park?
Yeah, this job.
Well, I think one of the most challenging parts of this job was when the archives changed from record groups, which I was very comfortable with, to this new archival system. And that took me a good couple years before I started feeling comfortable with it. And now to me it's a challenge to figure out where those two boxes right there? Those are 2018 archives just generated from our park alone, okay. Right there. Trying to figure out where every single piece of paper goes.
And you don't just put that whole box as a
itself. I have to decide this goes under historic preservation. This goes under natural resources. And where are natural resources? Oh, it goes under the toads. It goes under the amphibians reports. And where does this piece of paper go? Oh, this goes under special events. Which special events? Does it go under our park events? Does it go under our 25th anniversary events, centennial events? Well, so every single piece of paper that's been generated in the park, and most of them have gotten from emails. We also collect newspaper clippings. You have to figure out where they go.
Well, it's nice that the park is creating an archive of its own material that it produces, like the reports and all that. I don't know that that happens every place.
Well, we call it administrative archives, and we have them for every year.
That's great.
So from 2010, we have administrative archives, and this material that's been generated in the park, like all the reports that archaeology puts out, or maybe the natural resources, they put out a lot of reports. Maintenance will get their reports on buildings they've restored, for example, or treatments they've made, and so they all get filed in their respective.
And then as employees leave or retire, do their own personal file cabinets of stuff, like former superintendents and things?
Correct. Unfortunately, those are stacking up because we can't, and also these are kind of stacking up too because we can't really incorporate them until the other archives have been reorganized.
Right.
But as I'm reorganizing some, I am incorporating them because they're used. And I'll give you an example, natural resources. Every year, I'm asked to see the bird surveys from the year before and the amphibian surveys. So those have already been reorganized. As I'm acquiring new materials every summer, I'm incorporating those because they're used so much. And archaeology is the same way. They'll use those reports. They'll ask to see the Chilkoot Trail report from 3 years ago. And if it's archived, then I can quickly go get it and, you know, scan it for them, or they can come over here and look at the report and find the data. And they use those a lot. So those I try to keep up with. Okay. And some of the memos that we get are really important to our administration. So I'll try to incorporate those into the admin archives because they're important. They're going to be used.
So you currently have a museum curator?
No.
No.
We have had three museum curators. Our last one left in July this summer, 2018. She went back to Hawaii Volcanoes.
Mm-hmm. And who was that?
That was Christy Ausfresser.
Okay.
Ausfresser. Christy spelled K-R-S-T-I.
Okay.
And she was here about 2.5 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So after Samantha Rickert retired.
Samantha Rickert went to Washington
State.
Oh,
it was Deb who retired. Okay.
Debbie Sanders retired.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Then Samantha Rickert. And after that, Christy Ausfresser.
Okay.
And we don't have one right now. And I was planning on retiring in May, but we don't have a curator by then. I will stay if the park allows me to, until we do get a curator.
You need somebody here.
We need somebody here, and also I would like to be able to help the new curator get kind of established.
You haven't wanted to be the curator?
No. The technician, I think, has the more interesting job. But the problem with not having a curator is I get asked to do, like, reports, and I'm not familiar with how to do the reports. So I have to be walked through how to do the reports because they are required every year.
Right.
But fortunately, the new area regional curator is very helpful,
and
she will help me, and also other people who have done the reports, come to my aid. But I find that the hands-on working with artifacts and the archives is really enjoyable. So, and our curators also have gone to museum training, so they know how to store things properly. They know the laws, and I'm really glad just being a technician.
So, to finish up, anything else you want to say to conclude this?
Well, I appreciate Park Service taking me on, because it was not something that I had ever thought about doing, but I have learned so much. And if anybody's interested in being a technician or conservation, a conservator, I had never even worked with conservators until this job, but there is so much to learn, and you're continually learning, and it's never boring. I just find it a wonderful, wonderful job. If you like being challenged,
and
I find that there's so much to learn, and you never stop learning in this job. It's never boring.
Thank you so much for your time this afternoon. So unless there's anything else?
No. Thank you, Karen.
Thanks.